evil lurks in the hearts of men.
Terrible Tommy knows, and we're here at the bunker in Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Well, it's a beautiful day here, a little overcast in the Midwest, and we're still at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581, and thank you people for getting your donations in. And I'll have you know I sent out a fistful of money orders yesterday to some POWs. So anyhow, that'll make their day a little happier, a little more rosy. Yeah. Well, let's see here. I'm going to play you a little bit of show on the economy. And a lot of people say, well, we want to just talk about the race. Well, believe me, the economy is closely tied to any health or sickness of the race. So without watching the money system, the fake corrupt money system, and who controls it, you can't possibly know what's really happening to the race. So I'm going to play a little bit with Gerald Celente here. People have mixed emotions about Gerald. I know that Wolf Wall Street didn't think much of him, but when I listen to what he's saying and take it down and dissect it, it seems pretty straight this time. Next time, maybe not. So let's go.
As we report, IMAX Kaiser, time to return to the man in the white suit, Gerald Celente. Gerald, welcome back to the Kaiser Report.
Thanks for having me, Max.
Gerald, in the first half, we were talking about zombies. And there are many economic zombies. You know, the term, I think, first started being used to describe Japanese banks, who had gone bankrupt, essentially, back in the early 90s, and they were being floated through what was the Japanese invention, quantitative easing, and other machinations of the central bank to try to keep alive something that should be allowed to die. And this has had repercussions going forward. Now everyone's doing it, but not only in the banking sector, Gerald. We see zombies in the fracking industry. It's an economically unviable sector, and yet it's kept alive through cheap money. And now we're seeing it, as we covered in the first half, Chinese cement companies. They are losing money on every pound of cement they sell, but they're being kept alive with more transfusions of cheap money. You've got zombie cement manufacturers. Where is this all going, Gerald Celente?
They have to try to cover their debt. Look, you talked about fracking. Look here in the States, the junk bonds, what is about 15 to 20% of them in the energy industry?
Was that really up to 15 to 20% in the energy industry?
Yeah.
So to make the payments on those bonds, in an industry that can't afford even to keep the lights on because the energy prices are not high enough to sustain the debt needed to do the fracking, is absurd.
So what happens? They keep producing more supply than demand, and they keep pushing the prices lower. So it's, again, these are desperate moves for desperate people, because you know that whole big fracking thing. Every week there was a new story about another boom town. So all of this investment money, when you go across the board on it, it poured in. And now you're seeing companies, number one, go bankrupt, and number two, more mergers and acquisitions, which means that at some point when this does solidify, you'll have a lot fewer companies owning a lot more. So more multinationals growing a lot bigger as the rest of them go out of business.
Right. I mean, one of the prime beneficiaries of this boom and bust cycle that seems to be engineered by bankers, four bankers and their buddies, would be like a Warren Buffett, for example, who's heralded as a brilliant business guy, but other than acquiring companies with cheap money, he's not really adding anything to the economy. As a matter of fact, he's taking a competitiveness away from the economy by removing the competitive landscape and creating an oligopoly, a vertically integrated monopoly. He's become a robber baron. I mean, is it fair to say that Warren Buffett is a new form, really a robber baron? Is there anything wrong with that statement?
Well, all of these hedge funds, private equity groups, and what they do. I mean, let's look at the reality again. And you know, you've been talking about it for years. All of this cheap money has boosted the stock markets. Well, they've tripled since 2009 in the States. Why? Because of stock buybacks. You're borrowing money for nothing. And mergers and acquisition activity. Merger and acquisition activity now is on record, on track to break all-time records. So, of course, they're robber barons. It's no different But the only difference is they had laws in place to stop the robber barons that have been deregulated from Clinton and Reagan and others. What, from Glass-Steagall to Robertson-Patman Act to Sherman Antitrust Act to Clayton Antitrust Act, one after another, they've been deregulated. So it's a new form of robber baron.
It's interesting because you're saying that the mergers and acquisitions activity is hitting record high. If you go back 20, 30 years, mergers and acquisitions, going back to the 1980s, the leveraged buyouts, were driven by corporations assuming control of other corporations because the assets on their books were valued cheaply, and you could use those as the basis for a loan to take over a company and then sell those assets. But it was based on discounted assets. But in today's environment, these merger acquisitions are based on discounted money.
That's it.
It's a completely different paradigm.
That's right.
And you can't, it's very destructive in that sense, because the only way it continues is to keep money cheap. But keeping cheap money means commodities will continue to crash.
Commodities will continue to crash, and so too will the everyday people. Because once upon a time, when we were young guys, they used to have a thing called savings accounts. People actually used to put their money in a bank and get interest on it, and they actually retired on the stuff. Now you can't do that anymore, so it's only benefiting the major companies and the private equity groups that are borrowing money for free to buy back stocks and do deals.
All right, Gerald, you mentioned the savings account. For the millennials in the audience, a savings account is when you put money in the bank, and then the bank would pay you interest on your money at a level that was less than what they were charging people to borrow money from the bank. That used to be called the banking industry. You can look it up on Google. That's no longer with us. That's gone. There are no savings anymore. Not only are there no savings accounts, Gerald, not only are interest rates at zero, but now we're heading into negative interest rates. Negative interest rates. Can you give us a little background on what that means, negative interest rates, and how that plays out?
What it means is, particularly in Europe, if you put money in the bank, you have to they charge you to keep it there.
Now, I was with a friend of mine last night, a very famous guy. I won't mention his name. I won't drop his name. I'm not that crass, but people will probably figure it out. He's the only famous guy I know. But I told him this. And he said, so what incentive do you have to put your money in the bank?
I got a better one for you. Look what they did with German bonds and Swiss bonds. I'll tell you what. You buy them at this price, and when you cash them in 10 years, I'll give you less for it because I like you. You're a nice guy.
Right, but what's the incentive to do that?
They think it's security.
Right, because the alternative is to keep them cash in your apartment, in your flat, in your house.
And that's why I'm bullish on gold.
Okay, but in other words, the banks are charging you to store your cash.
Exactly.
So if the bank's going to charge me 1% to store my fiat money, and a gold bullion service is going to charge me 1% to store my gold bullion, why? What insane person would choose to store paper at a 1% fee instead of storing gold at a 1% fee?
How about what sane person would buy a German or Swiss bond that's going to pay him less than 10 years than buy gold at this price and not think gold is going to be worth more? And when we're talking in 10 years, if you don't think it's going to be worth more, fine. I don't give investment advice. I'm just saying how I look at it. And let's look at we're talking about declining currencies. So now you're in Russia, you're in Brazil, you're in Mexico. Hey, the Mexican peso is at an all-time low. If you had gold rather than pesos, real, or ruble, wouldn't you rather have gold? Because gold is what? Based on dollars, and your currency has declined so dramatically.
Well,
would you be ahead of the game?
Gold has hit new all-time highs against the Brazilian real.
Exactly.
It's doubled, tripled against the Russian ruble.
Exactly.
It's almost at new all-time highs against Japanese yen. It's not far off all-time highs in euros. It's all these other currencies around the world, it's either approaching or at or exceeded all-time highs, with the exception of the U.S. dollar, which is the world reserve currency, the linchpin currency. All commodities are priced in dollars. Post-World War II supremacy of America, the basis of the American empire, the basis of the new Gerald Celente drone for immigrant index, which we're going to create on your site. It's collateralized by a dollar. That's collateralized by the Pentagon. A dollar is backed up by a bomb. It's not backed up by gold. It's backed up by violence. You're having a peace conference in Kingston, and the turnout has been, shall we say, not robust because there's no money in peace. There's no money in peace. The peace market's crashing. Gerald, how can you think about having a peace conference in an environment where the value of peace has never traded lower? Is that a contrarian bet?
No, Dr. Paul Craig Robinson did a wonderful piece on it. He said commentators are saying the peace movement is dead, and I'm reviving it. But this is an action.
You're the Warren Buffett of peace.
Yeah, look, I'd rather fight for peace than die for war. And they're taking us to war. Hey, this is an old story. Currency wars, trade wars, world war. Anybody forget World War II? What are they? Every day you pick up the paper, currency wars, trade wars. You can see where it's leading. The whole Middle East is destabilized. War talk everywhere. And that's why we're pushing for peace. And with peace comes prosperity. That's what people don't get. And Bud, just let me tell you a little bit about what we're doing, this action plan. It's to close all the bases overseas, secure the homeland, put the troops to work rebuilding our rotted infrastructure rather than highways in Afghanistan, and force Congress to vote to go to war. Congress has not voted to go to war since World War II. And one little caveat, on each state ballot or referendum, that we the people will tell Congress how to vote. Because we pay for the war with our money and our lives, and Congress doesn't represent us. They represent the people that give them, will be polite, campaign contributions, or as we used to say in the Bronx, bribes and payoffs. So that's what this is about. It's about ending this violence that's only draining us morally, spiritually, and economically.
Okay, but war,
and rebuild America.
Who said war is a racket? Smedley?
Butler.
Thank you. But now, it's become the war has become a Ponzi scheme. Like, for example, in the Iraq War, that story where they delivered $8 billion, I believe the figure was, in a chopper, landed in cash, directly minted in Washington, to hand out to keep things going. Like, they've got $8 billion in cash unaccounted for to just spill in Iraq, and yet, somehow, magically, there's no money for infrastructure.
No.
There's no money for anything that supports peace. That's clearly, if you're giving $8 billion to warlords in Afghanistan, you're promoting war. Clearly, if you're spending $8 billion in the United States to build a bridge, you're promoting peace. So how do you... You're saying the peace market's undervalued. The peace... There should be a bull market in peace. There should be a bear market in war. But nobody in this economy is vested in peace. Nobody in this economy is outside the fact that their pension funds and their governments and their currency is vested in war. You said you had currency war, trade war, world war. We've seen the currency war. We've seen the trade war. Are we about to enter a world
war? Yes. You hear it all the time. Look at the, you know, it's every other day something about Putin. You know, you keep what's going on in the Middle East. It's out of control. It's out of control. After trillions, where did Stiglitz come up with the numbers? $7 trillion for Afghanistan and Iraq war? And nothing. Nothing. Other than more war. And look at the migration problem again, because of all the war. I have two friends of mine that are doctors in Syria. They had to move to Canada. That was a sophisticated economy. You know, a very high level culture. It's gone. Because Assad has to go. Who are you to say Assad has to go? You know, I have one of my four rules of peace. If you call him out, take him out. Yeah, you're gonna try. Why he has to go? Go take him out. I got an idea. We can make a lot of dough. We'll take out the arena in Verona and put Obama and Assad in there. We'll put it on pay per view. See who wins. I mean, these guys, they all tough talk, you know. But none of them are warriors. All they are commanders in chief.
Well, the peace conference sounds like it should be a must-go attempt for anybody who wants to reverse the course of what looks like a world war coming. Tell us a little more details about the peace conference.
September 20th at the most historic four corners in the United States where the seeds of democracy was sown up in Colonial Kingston. It's the only place where there are pre-Revolutionary War stone buildings on each corner. Kingston was the first capital of New York State. The Constitution that was written at the courthouse right across the street from us, 90% of that Constitution is America's Constitution. I mentioned George Washington, a real warrior, a guy that fought. No foreign entanglements, his farewell address. Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, Franklin, every one of them, no foreign entanglements. And that's what this is about. Bring home the troops, secure the homeland, rebuild America. The Rand Institute, they did a study.
Well, we've got to go.
Okay.
But Gerald Celente, the new George Washington of our times, you look the part. I'm ready to go in that direction. Thanks so much for being on the Kaiser Report.
Thank you.
Well, there you go, boys and girls. That's the latest. And If I were you and I had money, I'd probably be putting it into gold, but I don't think too many of us lone wolves have much money for gold. maybe pre-1964 silver coins, but I wouldn't keep too much, very much money in the bank, I'll tell you that. But if you can afford gold, now's the time to get in it, I guess. Not to turn it over all the time, but just to save it. But since I'm not an economist, you'll have to make up that decision for yourself. I want to say welcome back aboard to my good friend Lone Wolf Texas, or Lone Wolf Austin. He had a long siege with his wife was very sick. She finally passed away. And so he's getting back into the saddle now. So welcome back there, Lone Wolf Austin. Well, I got a little little behind on my pessimist guide to history, so let's get back in the groove here. 164 BC, deadly smallpox epidemic kills thousands. Soon after the Roman armies returned from the eastern Mediterranean, a smallpox epidemic broke out in Rome. The disease also spread throughout Europe and Persia, killing unknown thousands for over 10 years after the initial outbreak. And like I said, that's what war breeds, sickness and plague. 88 BC, massacre of 100,000 Romans. Mithridates VI, Eupator, ruler of the kingdom of Pontus along the Black Sea, took advantage of unrest in Rome. Wait a minute, I read that before. Sorry about that. Okay, 73 BC, the Roman gladiators revolt. The Roman gladiators were prisoners of war who were compelled to fight and kill each other as a public entertainment. In 73 BC, Spartacus, a Thracian soldier of noble birth, broke out of a training camp for gladiators in Capua with about 70 followers and began a general uprising among the gladiators and slaves. By the following year, Spartacus had organized a ragtag army of over 100,000 escaped gladiators, slaves, and outlaws that rampaged through what is now Italy. Spartacus's men fought well in battle, defeating Roman armies sent to recapture them. They avenged themselves by pillaging and raping their former Roman captors. Any prisoners they took were crucified or forced to slaughter each other in combat, just as the gladiators themselves had been compelled to do. Though Spartacus apparently hoped to lead his men back to their homelands, he was ultimately unsuccessful in persuading them to lay down their swords. After many victories, Spartacus was finally trapped in a desperate battle in southern Italy. Thousands of his men were killed in battle by armies under the Roman consul Crassus, who devised a cruel mass punishment for the thousands of rebels he took prisoner. Crassus lined both sides of the road from Capua to Rome with some 6,000 crucifixes, binding a captured rebel on each one of them. The sight of so many crucifixes stretched into the distance, a man slowly dying on each, satisfied the Romans that their slaves would not dare revolt again. Well, interesting. I think I saw that picture in a movie one time of all those bodies hanging on crosses. So the baby Jesus wasn't the only one. Okay, 44 BC, Julius Caesar assassinated. On March 15th, despite warnings and omens of impending misfortune, Julius Caesar made his way through the streets of Rome to a meeting of senators at Pompey's Theater. Much like politicians do today, who get in their little cars and go places and appear before people. Along the way, a passerby thrust a petition into Caesar's hand and implored him to read it, but Caesar received scores of petitions every day and decided this one could wait. That proved to be a fatal mistake, which politicians make all the time. Before Caesar's rise to supreme power, Rome had been a republic run by a senate of wealthy patricians who often passed laws designed to protect the privileged status of the wealthy. Gee, that's something new. Wonder when they came up with that. Though a patrician by birth, Julius Caesar aligned himself with the populist factions. Oh, Mr. Trump! Eventually sharing the rule of empire with two other consuls in the first triumvirate. Caesar's conquest of Gaul made him a hero in Rome, and he eventually made himself sole ruler of the empire. Might as well have one as 400 or 500 congressmen like we do that aren't worth a shit. Can't make up their mind about anything except going to war. Caesar then enjoyed widespread popularity both for his military achievements and the reforms he pushed through the Senate. But many of the senators resented his arrogance and his control over them. Yeah, that's right. They longed to regain their power, corrupt power. After 5 years of Caesar's autocratic rule, his enemies in the Senate formulated a plot to kill him and restore the Republic. Back to square one and corruption. The primary conspirator was Gaius Cassius, who soon recruited several other senators to the cause, among them Publius Servilius Casca, Lucius Tillus Cimber, Decimus Brutus, and Marcus Junius Brutus, rumored to be Caesar's illegitimate son. News of the plot spread rapidly, and within 2 weeks, more than 60 senators knew of it. Not an exact secret, you'd think that Caesar would have moved against them. Only a few, however, knew that the deed was to occur at the meeting of the Senate on March 15th. Caesar should have moved first. When the appointed day arrived, Caesar's wife, Calpurnia, begged him not to leave the house because she had dreamed of his death the night before and reminded him that a fortune teller had predicted the Ides of March, the 15th, would be fatal to him. Moved by his wife's entreaties, Caesar had just decided to remain at home when Decimus Brutus arrived and chided him for yielding to such nonsense, finally persuading him to attend. Never ignore those kinds of things. Never ignore them. You get an idea in your head, something comes up, and you, or a dream or something. Listen to it. On the way to the meeting, a passerby stopped Caesar and begged him to read a petition. The parchment warned Caesar of the assassination plot against him, and had he read it, Caesar might well have lived. But he merely took the petition and went on his way to Pompey's theater. Well, you see, if there are 60 senators already involved in the plot, what kind of security, what kind of FBI did he have? His intelligence ability seemed to be bullshit. And he's an autocrat? An autocrat's got to have all kinds of security. Because you're only one guy, man. Meanwhile, all these kind of things employ, what do you call it? Now I'll think of it a little bit. It's never just one guy. One guy always has his guys. Hitler, Mussolini, Roosevelt, they've always got their own circle of buddies. Oligarchs. Meanwhile, the conspirators had already assembled there, armed with daggers in their stylus cases. Daggers are a good, very good weapon for that kind of thing. Up close and you make sure. Gunshots at a distance may prove to be... I mean, a lot of people are shot several times and still live. But a knife in the right area and you're done. You'll bleed out in 2 minutes. They had managed to prevent the senators loyal to Caesar from attending the meeting so that no one present would interfere with their plan. Third clue. First, 60 senators had already signed up for this. Then his wife warns him. And then the guy along the road warns him. And Caesar entered the chamber of Pompey's theater shortly after noon, still holding the unread parchment. Jeez. and sat in a recessed area below a statue of Pompey, as Tullius Cimber pretended to petition Caesar for the return of his brother from exile. Casca slipped behind Caesar and stabbed him. Caesar jabbed back at Casca with his stylus, but the other senators quickly closed in around him, their daggers raised. In the frenzy of stabbing that followed, the conspirators hacked mercilessly at Caesar, wounding each other in the process. Then they abandoned Caesar's lifeless body, riddled with 35 stab wounds, at the foot of Pompey's statue. Their treacherous deed was done, but its results was not what they had planned. The Republic was not restored, and Rome suffered years of instability and civil war before Caesar's great-nephew Octavian became sole ruler of the empire as Augustus Caesar. This infamous assassination did, however, provide William Shakespeare with the plot for one of his most famous plays, an immortal line, "Et tu, Brute?" I remember in high school I had to learn that speech by Mark Antony, and for years I remembered every line of it, but I don't think I could repeat much of it today. So, there was a good education in a very short time. You would always, if you're in a position of power or sensitive situation, you always have to be watching out. You have to be paranoid. You have to be watching everybody all the time. And if someone gives you a clue that something may be happening, check it out. If someone hands you a note that something may be happening, read it. And so forth and so on. Or you may end up like Caesar. A pincushion. And that's the end of our reading from our great book, The Pessimist's Guide to History. I sent one of those books about the good old days they weren't, which is one of my favorite books. I sent it to a POW out in California. He just sent me a letter today. He said he's in solitary on a trumped-up charge. That's going to take on a new meeting, trumped up. But he's in there in solitary, and he really loves that book. I always try on some of the more responsible POWs in prison to send them Jack London's Star Rover. I think that's a great book for everybody to read, but it's even more important for prisoners to read it. Here's a famous quote for you from Yuri Andropov. Remember, he became the leader of Russia for a time. Then ambassador to Hungary and later secretary general of the USSR's Communist Party, speaking on the Soviet invasion of Hungary. Quote, "Believe me, General, the Soviet people are Hungary's best friends." Here's a couple of quotes from guys who are about to be executed. Hubie Franklin Ferris Jr., who killed a police detective during a robbery, speaking to his executioner moments before dying in the electric chair. Quote, "Let's get on with it." Jimmy Glass, convicted of murdering a Louisiana couple in 1987, uttered his last words while being strapped to the electric chair. Quote, "I'd just as soon be fishing." Crawford Goolsbee, a.k.a. Cherokee Bill, outlaw, robber, and murderer, when asked if he had anything to say before the noose was put around his neck at his hanging. Quote, "I came here to die, not give a speech." John Jack Gilbert Graham, who sabotaged the plane flight his mother was on, killing her and 43 others in the process, speaking his last words to a reporter as he was sitting in the death chamber. Quote, "Yeah, I like you to sit on my lap as they close the door in here." John Heath, robber and cattle rustler in the Old West. He was sentenced to life in prison, but instead was hanged by a group of vigilante miners to whom he said the above. Quote, "I have faced death too many times to be disturbed when it actually comes." Well, anyhow, there's some That's from a book. It's quite interesting. In fact, it quotes me in here. I don't know whether I can find it real quick or not. Let's see here. Let me see here. Got Timothy McVeigh in here. Oh, yeah, here it is. They quote me twice, 106 and 122. Okay. Well, let's see here. Oh, yeah. Tom Metzger, neo-Nazi and founder of White Aryan Resistance, war on the murder of an Ethiopian boy who was living in the United States. Quote, sounds like the skinheads did a civic duty. Yeah, well, that's when I first heard about the crimes that the blacks were involved in, wife, girlfriend, beating, drugs, everything. And so I had no idea skins were even involved. So I said, sounds like the skinheads did a civic duty when I heard it. I believe that too today. Well, let's look here. 106, was it? Ah, well. Anyhow, this is from a book called Criminal Quotes. 1,000 Most Bizarre Things Ever Said by History's Outlaws, Gangsters, Despots, and Other Evildoers. So I got honorable mention being in there twice. How about that, boy? I am bad. I'll bet you thought the first time we were in Iraq was when idiot, stupid, warmongering George Bush Jr. took us there. Well, listen to this from the book Smoke, Human Smoke. Some Iraqi troops gathered on a plateau near Fallujah, Iraq. It was May 1941. Churchill in his bombproof map room had his eyes now on the Middle East. Yugoslavia and Greece, set ablaze with then left in Nazis' hands, were lost, but Axis forces might yet swarm over from somewhere and capture Iraq's oil. Troops should be sent to Basra as fast as possible, Churchill wrote to General Ismay of the Chiefs of Staff. The Iraqi Prime Minister Rashid Ali sent word that he would not allow any more disembarkations of British troops until the troops already in Basra had moved on. Churchill ordered the landings to proceed. British civilians left Baghdad seeking protection at the Royal Air Force training base at Lake Habananya. They got on flying boats and flew to safety. Churchill told General Wavell to mount a general offensive in Iraq. General Wavell contested the order. There weren't enough troops, he said, and there were other countries to consider. He advised negotiations with Rashid Ali. Churchill countermanded him, wherein Wavell sent a warning. Quote, I consider the prolongation of the fighting in Iraq will seriously endanger the defense of Palestine and Egypt, Wavell said. The political repercussions will be incalculable. He asked again to be allowed to negotiate. I'm deeply disturbed at General Wavell's attitude, Churchill wrote in dismay. To Wavell, he said, you do not need to bother too much about the long future in Iraq. Wavell's job was to break into the Baghdad, even with quite a small force, trounce Rashid Ali and take a friendly government and set it up there. That was Wavell's assignment. Iraqi troops threatened the British flying school at Habananya. Rashid Ali was appealing to Berlin for help. It was time for air control. Churchill told Wavell to tell the commander of the flying school that his duty to defend Habananya to the last. The commander, a man named Smart, rose to the occasion. On May 2, 1941, RAF flight instructors and their cadets made almost 200 flights over the Iraqis on the plateau, some of them flying out seven times, dropping wing-mounted bombs and returning. 22 out of the 64 airplanes were wrecked, and 10 pilots lay dead or so badly wounded that they couldn't fly. Iraqi airplanes, including American-made Northrop Douglas attack bombers with Wright Cyclone engines and semi-retractable bomb sights, arrived on the scene and began strafing and bombing the flight school and its polo field. Iraq situation was pretty bad, wrote Undersecretary Cadogan. Are we really going to be beaten by the Iraqis? Cadogan authorized the Air Committee to say that if Habyarimana fell, the Royal Air Force would bomb Baghdad. There's a little time capsule for you. We've been in Iraq many times, many times. And, of course, all the way back with Alexander the Great. And now with all that depleted uranium all over the place, it's going to be amazing if anything will grow, including people, unless they're freaks. Because I forget that one town that we creamed with depleted uranium in a big battle over there. And they've got so many birth defects and screwed up people that it's unbelievable. This stuff's going, who knows how many decades or how many hundred years this will affect the population of the Middle East. Maybe there won't be able to even be anybody in the Middle East. It'll be Israel all by itself. Then it'll be peaceful, but then it won't be happy because it's got nobody against them. I'm convinced that Jews love to have people hate them. It gives them a thrill. I read some out of this book, The Jew Comes to America, which is a pretty old book. Let's see here. And some of the cartoons in it are something else. They look just like A. Wyatt Man's cartoons, like I said. This book was republished by the Thunderbolt. They did a good job at finding these old books and reprinting them. And J.B. Stoner and Dr. Edward R. Fields. Let me read a little bit more out of this book. An old man who was rounded out long years of honor in the community and who by his sterling worth and eminent business capacity was amassing a large fortune reaches the end of his career and dies, full of years and honor. One of his children comes within reach of a Jew lawyer, and straight away the history of that old man's life is subjected to a microscopic search for something which may tarnish his fair name and help to subvert his will. Do you notice how that is now? A lot of very popular people that as soon as they're dead, after a few years, they all of a sudden dig up all the dirt on them. That's typically a Jewish trait. From New York to Michigan, a Jew lawyer prowls in search of fuel to feed the unholy flame. He delves into the secrets of the sick room. He notes all the sickening details of his last agonies. He even reaches through the door of death and into the portals of the tomb and drags forth the secrets of the mortal remains and flaunts them in the face of justice. And thus, week after week and month after month, the mass of putrid details is spread upon the record of a will contest until the justice herself almost sickens at the unfilial exhibition. Yet this is a fair picture of the contest over the will of Jesse Hoyt, the details of which are still fresh in the public mind and in the public prints, and which was begun and urged on by a Jewish lawyer. And for this ghoulish work, this obscure Jew lawyer, who, by the way, was also an ex-pawnbroker, whose license had been revoked by order of the mayor for irregular proceedings, sought to charge a fee of a size hitherto unknown to even the greatest lights. In 1873, an old man died in the city of New York. His children, aided by a Jew lawyer, bitterly opposed the probate of his will because of certain provisions therein made for their stepmother. Thereupon arose one of the most hotly contested will cases in history of the state. The children sought to prove their dead father to have been an imbecile, for a long time prior to his decease, and a disgusting array of facts were adduced in support of this allegation. Not content with aspersing the memory of their dead father, their attorney conceived the idea of making a flank attack upon his wife, and thereupon applied, and it was believed to have been the only instance of such an application of judicial history in the state, for the issuance of the long, obsolete, and barbarous common law writ De Venture Inspicitio, in order to compel her to submit to a humiliating examination of her person to determine whether or not she was likely to become a mother. Whoa. The application was denied in a manner which renders it most likely, unlikely, that another such effort will ever be made in the state of New York. The Jews being essentially a commercial race, it is the domain of commercial law that the Jew lawyer finds a large field for his activity. Here his inherent dishonesty finds ample room for exercise and development. The books of law abound with cases of dishonest partnerships, fraudulent assignments, questions of the accommodation business paper or accommodation endorsements, questions of guarantee and suretyship, questions arising about the various phases of the law of sales, the statute of frauds, and all the various and complicated field of commercial law, and in them we may always expect to find and do find the Jew lawyer, aiding and abetting his clients in the repudiation of their obligations and in fleeing their business associates. So marked has this become, especially in the matter of fraudulent preferences and in insolvent assignments, that it has crystallized in the witticism that whereas the Jews were formerly the chosen people, they are now the preferred people. The fact bears out the statement. The records of the courts and of the experience of the bar prove incontestably that 9/10 of the fraudulent assignments are made by Jew clients acting under the advice and guidance of Jew lawyers. If only 1/2 of the statements which are contained in scores of affidavits in attachment proceedings now on file with New York County Courthouse are true, they present an indictment of both the Jew in business and of his legal advisors, before which business community may well stand appalled. If the law register and the papers of S.H. Nealon, the legal advisor of the house of H.B. Clatman and Company, should be examined, and the details of that firm's various legal struggles with their Jew customers and their Jew legal advisors could be laid before the public, that alone would furnish abundant confirmation, if any be needed, of the innate and total depravity of the commercial Jew and his legal cohorts. Bold, unblushing perjury, allied with ineffable impudence and brazen assertion, all marshaled and led by the low cunning of Jew lawyers, swagger through the halls of justice until thinking men wonder where it will all end. And what must be inevitable destiny of the commercial metropolis, where such is the apparent standard of business and honesty? Well, I'll tell you where it ends. A crash, just like we're heading for right now. It follows as inevitably as the day follows night that a high standard of business honesty is impossible, and the moral tone of the business community is lowered and is constantly but surely sinking lower still. The Aryan must fight fire with fire, or he be worsted in an unequal contest. He must oppose cunning with cunning and match the strategy of his antagonist with equal art, or retire from the field. Many prefer the latter course, and the writer knows of more than one instance where honorable merchants have been obliged to give up their businesses because they could not and would not stoop to the business habits and practices of their Jew competitors, but preferred to abandon the field such as true reason for the disappearance of such a merchant as Duncan A. Grant, whose honesty alone stood in the way of his making a fortune. A phase of the Jewish character is well illustrated by an anecdote told by a former proprietor of a well-known Broadway eating house. A Jewish firm consisted of a father and several sons carried on their business near him. They had been in the habit, for reasons of economy, of bringing a light lunch from home and disposing of it at their place of business. One day, one of the sons happened into his eating house at lunch hour and had his attention drawn to the custom there in vogue, and which was then a novelty in New York, by which each guest helped himself to what he wished to eat, and after he had satisfied his hunger, stated to an attendant stationed near the cashier's desk the amount of his indebtedness, the price of the viands being displayed in large figures, and received a check for the sum he stated, which check he would pay to the cashier's desk as he passed out. The quick intelligence of the young Hebrew comprehended at a glance the possibilities of the situation, as the proprietor had to depend upon each one stating truly the amount of his indebtedness. He thereupon proceeded to eat 50 cents worth, called for a 15-cent check, paid it, and walked out. The next day, the whole family were on hand to take advantage of this manna, which had so providentially, as it seemed to them, been provided for them. And for 3 weeks, they systematically and religiously ate enormous lunches at the expense of the proprietor, until they were discovered and unceremoniously ejected from the place. To them, it seemed a perfectly proper and legitimate business transaction, and their only regret was to have been caught so speedily. Okay, I'm going to knock this off for right now. The Jew Comes to America. And I have something else I want to play for you that I got from the left. Yes, I go to the left a lot, and because not all right-wingers are liars, and not all left-wingers are liars, and you have to find the information where you can find it.
Who causes those, or what is responsible, or who is responsible, or what are the circumstances that lead to, you know, I mean, we can get all intellectual until hell freezes over trying to find answers, but I think we know, at least in this part of the world, for the past 15 years, we know what has happened. We really do. And now there are 10 slimy war criminals who orchestrated and designed the Iraq War. You might call them the architects of that war, who are now trying to sabotage the deal that the U.S. and five other countries worked out with Iran, where it concerns Iran's development of nuclear power. As Zaid Jilani at Aldernet puts it, there's a fierce battle going on in Washington with progressive and pro-diplomacy organizations facing off against pro-Israel organizations to prevent a veto-proof vote to kill Obama's deal with Iran. Now, as of yesterday, of course, let me digress, as of yesterday, with the announcement by Senator Barbara Mikulski that she was going to support the Iran deal, Obama now has the veto-proof number of senators to get this deal passed. But never mind, almost every single Republican candidate has declared that if made the party's nominee, and if that candidate then becomes president, the Iran deal, along with the Affordable Care Act, will be immediately demolished. You know, I've said it so many times on this program, I know you're tired of hearing it, but Republicans, all Republicans, want war. They are liars, they are cowards, cheats, frauds, religious fanatics. They want death and destruction. I've never been able to figure out why, except to fall back on the definition of a sociopath. And I truly do believe, I do believe this now. After all the decades I've been alive and all the personal observation or research or reading or listening or watching or hearing, I've come to that conclusion that every single Republican, no, I don't care if it's your mama, too bad, every single Republican is an active or passive sociopath. By definition. Now, as Jelani puts in his article, these anti-Iran deal organizations are joined by a number of hawkish figures whose last great foreign policy foray was our last diplomatic catastrophe, the Iraq War. It wasn't just a diplomatic catastrophe. It was a catastrophe for the hundreds of thousands, million plus, who have been butchered, died, blown to pieces, killed, murdered in their own countries, their own homes, living their own lives. Here are 10 Iraq war supporters who are now trying to kill our best chance for peace with Iraq, or Iran. George W. Bush. This clown has apparently learned nothing from the experience, arguing in April that Obama negotiating with Iran was, Bush's word, naive. Bush calling somebody naive is like a toad calling a frog ugly. Bill Kristol, a Zionist, longtime Republican operator who today is a board member of the Anti-Deal Emergency Committee for Israel. He was one of the biggest proponents of the Iraq War. In March 2003, he said, quote, "We will, in fact, be greeted as liberators." And from his perch at the Weekly Standard, the Zionist Kristol has asked lawmakers to, his words, kill the deal. David Frum, another Zionist. Frum was a Bush administration speechwriter who coined the term Axis of Evil to describe the governments of Iraq, Iran, and North Korea in order to justify the war push. Linking North Korea with Iran and Iraq will show you, gentle listener, the depth of David Frum's mental disease. Today, Frum not only opposes the Iran deal, but also has suggested that Obama is engaged in anti-Semitic rhetoric for calling out lobbyists who are trying to sink the agreement. Anti-Semitic. That's the favorite term of a Zionist. If you criticize the policies of Israel, the internal policies, the policies that they use as an occupier, or the policies that are threatened, constantly threatened, against people in the Middle East, if you criticize or question those policies, you are automatically, to the Zionists, an anti-Semite. The odd part, of course, is hardly any of the rulers in Israel are Semitic people. But I digress. Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham said the war with Iraq was, quote, the only reasonable option. And today, Lindsey Graham says that the deal with Iran is like throwing, quote, a can of gasoline on a fire, end quote. John McCain, Graham's fellow senator, said Iraq was, quote, the right war for the right reasons. And he completely supported the invasion and the killing. McCain mocks Obama's diplomatic effort, saying the Iran agreement is an attempt by the Obama administration to seek nirvana. These people are just goddamn insane. Do you understand? Yeah, you do. Of course you do. Dick Cheney, who represents or is the warmongering arm of the warmongering Republican Party, was a mastermind of the Iraq War He's claimed the deal, worked out with Iran, would put us closer to nuclear war than any time since World War II, yada, 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 yada. I wish he would just cease to exist. Joe Lieberman, another Zionist, former Democratic vice presidential candidate who turned against his own party over the Iraq War, has stepped up to lead the so-called United Against Nuclear Iran. After the last chairman of the group stepped down because he decided to support what Obama and the other five nations worked out. Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, was outside the government in 2002, but he was still called to testify, telling lawmakers he had no doubts about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. And now he says diplomacy with Iran threatens the entire world. Eli Lake, he was a reporter for UPI, arguing about the threat of the fantasy Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. Today, he's a one-man propaganda operation at Bloomberg View, claiming that Obama is practicing what Eli calls the politics of fear in order to achieve peace rather than the war that Mr. Lake would like to see launched against Iran. And, of course, AIPAC. The American Israel Public Affairs Committee, the main Zionist pro-Israel lobbying group, lobbied on behalf of the Iraq War. Today, it is engaged in a no-holds-barred fight to kill the Iran deal, with the donors to AIPAC pledging to spend as much as $40 million. Now, as Jelani puts it at the end, the irony of all this is that the Iraq War set up the diplomatic arrangements we are finalizing today. The war in Iraq expanded Iranian influence, and the West's negotiations with Iran are partly a result of a nuclear program that was ramped up in the wake of U.S. wars with Iran's neighbors. There's also added pressure to deal with Iran on the mutual interest of containing ISIS, which would likely never have emerged but for the Iraq War. The nuclear deal is simply an attempt to clean up the mess made by the Iraq War architects themselves. Saeed Jelani writing at Alternet, and while you don't need to be a weatherman to know which way the wind is blowing, you don't need to be an expert on foreign policy to understand the sociopathic, murderous attitudes of these Nazis who now run the U.S. government, who run the think tanks, who run the media, who are pushing for more war, more death, more destruction. And then, of course, you have Hitler Jr. himself, Donald Trump. We'll be back.
Well, there you go. How about that? That's from the left. And it's about time we sort of exchange things. And I've been doing it for quite a while. The right wing, forget it. They're going to support this Republican Party or offsprings of the Republican Party to the end. And you notice Donald Trump, that's become this populist kind of guy. He's 100% for more military, 100% for more weapons. That's one of your keys right there. You can't support anybody that's for a larger war budget. So $1 trillion a year. Ah, jeez. And as far as Trump being a Nazi, a Hitler, you'd realize that those guys in the high command and Hitler's entourage all had high IQs, 130, 140, 150. And these guys are running around over here, these hacks. I wonder whether they could break 100. But one thing we do know, they're all psychopaths. You can take that to the bank. That's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on, Thursday? Yeah, tomorrow's Thursday. Today's Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. That's right. We'll see you then, 14:05, and especially 5, I have nothing to say. And whatever you do, never lie to a Fed. Just don't say anything to a Fed. That'll really make his day. People are asking me how long is Hillary going to last. I don't know. She's pretty smart. I mean, she's clever. She's a survivor. She may get out of this yet, but if we had an attorney general worth a damn, she'd been indicted a long time ago.
But I always knew I was doing the right thing. Because you have a steadiness about you. And I believe in you. But it comes home, and you must be smarter than your enemy. What are you trying to say? The Americans, they're very smart, but sometimes they can be incredibly stupid. They spend all this money and time and energy on the so-called war on terror. They put satellites up in space. They can ram a smart bomb up a camel's ass from a situation room 5,000 miles away. But every time the U.S. kills an Al-Qaeda leader, what happens? There's a new one before the body is cold. You do it a million times. They never get it because the real solution always eludes them. That is, do nothing.
Nothing.
Nada. If you want to shut down a fundamentally flawed system, all you gotta do is step out of its way, and it'll shut itself down. Nature has a way of correcting itself.